This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there, Andrew West bringing you the Religion and Ethics Report. How did tension between ethnic and religious groups influence the outcome of the federal election? How is a Vatican decree rejecting the idea of gender fluidity being felt among gay and gender diverse Christians? And the internet promised its own form of utopia. So what went wrong?
The whole premise of the web was it was going to be this tool to bring people together in collaboration to create things that had never been created before. And I don't see much really being created at the moment apart from anger and outrage. And when that flows into political discussions, they're not very productive, are they?
First to a new analysis of voting by multicultural communities at the federal election. It's found sharp divisions over immigration may have helped the coalition to victory in key seats. The study by two experts at the University of Sydney suggests many Asian voters opposed increased migration from the Middle East. And even communities that weren't especially religious were mobilised by effective campaigns on social questions such as same-sex marriage. One of the study's co-authors is Dr. Christina Ho.
It seems a bit of a brutal term to, you know, sort of lump all the people from migrant backgrounds together. I mean, in the past, in previous generations, when most migrants were working class migrants, they came as family reunion migrants, perhaps there was more of a unity among them. But, you know, we've had such a diversification of our migration program. Most migrants now come as skilled migrants. They're quite highly educated. They're not voting in the same way as, you know, post-war migrants did.
I did hear as recently as two or three election cycles ago about some interesting Labor Party research that said the most reliable indicator of one's willingness to vote Labor was how recently you became a citizen. Does that have any ring of truth to it?
I think there's actually a real proliferation in the kinds of factors that determine how people vote. And so it is really difficult. There was this so-called Bowen thesis.
Of Chris Bowen, the shadow treasurer.
Yeah, that's right, that Labor lost people of faith. You know, when you drill down into some of the numbers, I don't think it's possible to make those kinds of generalizations.
Yeah, although he was talking very specifically about his seat of McMahon in Western Sydney and feedback that he had got, and a number of other Labor MPs said this was the direct feedback they got post-election, mind you.
Right, yes.
That faith issues may have played a significant but not overwhelming role.
I mean, I had a look at some of the figures from some of these marginal seats that were very migrant heavy, including Banks, which is nearby and has a very high Chinese population. In the previous election, they had voted a lot for Christian minor parties. There, the impact of the debate about same-sex marriage and safe schools was really important. But this time around, it seems like that vote largely vanished. There was a huge fall in the percentage going to Christian minor parties. Pretty much went straight back to the Liberals.
But I wonder if that wasn't because, on this occasion, the coalition had a leader who strongly identified as a practicing Christian, very unambiguous about it. So maybe people who were seeking to express their religious preference through a Christian minor party just went straight to the coalition.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably what happened. You know, they looked at Scott Morrison, they saw him as one of them. So there was really no need to go. Before, they would vote Christian minor party and the preference would flow to the Liberals generally anyway. This time, I think they just went straight to the Liberals.
There's some really interesting research that you've done, and it's in your most recent article in The Conversation, where you suggest some inter-ethnic tension that may have emerged in the voting, where communities from East Asia may have been seen to vote against the interests of communities from the Middle East. Is that how we could put it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was some evidence of that. There was some fear-mongering in some of the, maybe the Chinese speaking, you know, social media, WeChat, etc. There was a lot of so-called fake news. You know, frankly, fear-mongering about Muslim immigration, the parent visas. I mean, I think a lot of that fed into some anxieties and amplified those anxieties, which again drove some of those voters away from Labor.
So putting it bluntly, Christina, was there a fear of increased, quote-unquote, Middle Eastern immigration among some Chinese and East Asian communities?
It's hard to say definitively, but I think judging from some of the debates, the discussions going on in social media, there was some successful, you know, fear-mongering, I think you would have to call it that. There's always been a kind of anxiety around refugees, around Muslim Australians in some of these communities. There was some concerted efforts on the part of certain political forces to really fuel those fears.
What's the basis of that tension?
This is more speculative, I guess, because what I've done is I've just looked at the numbers, and it's hard to say from the numbers. There is some intercommunal tensions there. I mean, I think a lot of East Asian migrants came as skilled migrants, they're educated professionals, they see themselves as the quote-unquote model minority. Mm. And in fact, we had people like Gladys Liu, who was the Liberal candidate, successful Liberal candidate in Chisholm in Victoria, who was making some pretty direct comments about basically Chinese migrants being the model migrants. You know, they work hard and they pay taxes and they're aspirational. They're not on welfare, unlike some other. That would have swayed some voters.
Yeah. To what extent would what is ostensibly a religious issue like same-sex marriage play into communities, say mainland Chinese communities that are not hugely religious? It's still what strikes at a social conservatism in a community like that, even if it doesn't identify as strongly religious or not?
I think that's what's happening. When you look at the official data, people who are born in China have very low levels of, you know, religiosity, according to the census. And that's obviously because they come from a communist country where there's been banning of religion. There may be some fear about, you know, disclosing any religious affiliation. But underlying that, you're right, there is a lot of this kind of deep social conservatism, a moral conservatism that aligns with certain Christian politics, regardless of whether they're church going.
Mm. How much of this, Christina, comes down to the ability of the Liberal Party to talk now very effectively to specific ethnic communities? Because for probably a couple of generations, it's been thought Labor speaks more effectively, more empathetically to migrant communities. But I've got to say, in New South Wales and Victoria, for example, the coalition looks like it's been very successful.
This time round, especially, the Liberal Party was quite effective in engaging with certain migrant communities. I was out in the suburbs on election day in a very Chinese-heavy area and noticed that there were small armies of Chinese-speaking workers that the Liberals had on each polling booth, you know, upwards of 10 on each polling booth. They were greeting voters in Mandarin, you know, sometimes by name. So they'd obviously gone to a lot of effort to try and recruit these people to stand all day at the polling booths. They also had some, obviously, you know, high-profile candidates from Asian backgrounds. I think this election there was an unprecedented number of Asian Australian candidates running for many of the parties, Labor and Liberal, but also for the minor parties. In fact, probably more so for the minor parties. And this is something that I found really interesting. In New South Wales, I actually did a count of all the candidates standing for election, and almost half of the candidates standing for the Christian Democratic Party had Asian surnames. And that's probably conservative, because I was just counting the surnames that were obviously Asian. That was actually more than for any other political party. The parties are investing a lot more time and energy into looking at migrant communities, and some parties are obviously being quite successful at that.
Yeah. Can we conclude, as I suppose I did, I don't know whether it was premature or not, 2 weeks before the election in a program, that it was impossible really to separate an embrace of multiculturalism from a support for multi-faith communities, that the two almost go hand in hand?
Yeah, overall in Australia, the migrants are the people that are keeping up the religiosity of this society. You know, if it weren't for migrants, Australia would be a lot less religious. So political parties have cottoned on to that. And the rise of obvious visible religion among candidates is something that has been quite noticeable over a longer period. And I think that that has been quite powerful in tapping into migrant communities.
Mm. Great to talk to you. Dr. Christina Ho, she's a senior lecturer in social and political sciences at the University of Technology, Sydney, with Andrew Yakubovich, who's the emeritus professor of sociology. She's done a very interesting analysis of the so-called ethnic vote in the recent election. It was published in a recent edition of The Conversation. Christina, thanks for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
You're most welcome, Andrew.
Pope Francis has embraced gay and lesbian Christians. He famously said, "Who am I to judge about a gay Catholic and his relationship with the Church?" But in a new document, the Vatican draws the line at so-called gender fluidity. It says, and I quote, "The oscillation between male and female becomes, at the end of the day, only a provocative display against so-called traditional frameworks." Now, the document's aimed mainly at education systems that promote gender ideology. But how is it being received among gay Christians? The Reverend Alex Pittaway leads a Brisbane congregation of the Metropolitan Community Church, which includes former Catholics and Pentecostals. He's also a chaplain at the University of Queensland, and Alex Pittaway joined me in our Brisbane studio.
What this document sets out is a document that completely ignores the variations of gender that are within creation itself. There are seven different types of gender variation, that is, of intersex people, that is a medical reality that doctors encounter. And this document completely ignores that and smushes everyone into a male and female binary. And this document, which is seeking to be a place for dialogue and reaching out, is in fact another way that the Catholic Church has excluded people who are transgender, people who are intersex, people who don't fit within that binary of male and female. And it's deeply concerning for the people in my congregation.
Well, what does a minister in the Metropolitan Community Church, which is not an exclusively gay church, but it is broadly a church for LGBT people, what is your concern with what a Pope says?
The document, I think, is mostly quoting theologians, and it's mostly quoting people who study church documents, Vatican documents, papal letters and so on. There is nothing which has the lived experience of people who have a diverse gender. The Pope and the Catholic Church are basing how they are going to deal with people of diverse gender with no reference at all to the lived experiences of trans and gender diverse people. If they did, they would see that it's not like trans or gender diverse people are suddenly waking up in the morning and thinking, oh, I'm going to have tea and coffee. Oh, and I'm also going to change my gender. It doesn't work like that. It's people who have been through long journeys accompanied with medical professionals who are realizing that they can't be fully who they are unless they can express the gender that has always been within them.
Is there a significance for you that this document was released? It doesn't have this Pope's name on it, but it was released in his pontificate. Given the much more inclusive tone that this Pope has taken?
I think there are a few significant points about this document and about the papacy of Pope Francis. When I first heard of Pope Francis's election and how he was going to be a pope who spoke up for the marginalized, spoke up for those who have known oppression, I, like many other people, were excited. Excited that at last we had a more inclusive tone. And I saw small baby steps forward when he made that statement to the press, "Who am I to judge," about a particular gay priest who was uncovered in the Vatican. Unfortunately, what we have seen with this pontificate has been a double-edged sword. On the one hand, we have seen a change in tone, but we have seen a level of double-stepping which has confused many LGBTI people and has brought back LGBTI people into Catholic congregations only to be shown the door and only to be rejected.
Yeah, although the pastoral approach is much different. I mean, and this is something that you, as both a minister and a university chaplain, would appreciate. The Pope met with a Spanish transgender man who had been ostracized by his priest. The Pope embraced that man. The Vatican is taking on what it says is an ideology, is a theory, rather than surely the lived experience of pastoring to people who are transgender.
As you say, I'm a chaplain at Emmanuel College, which is a residential college at University of Queensland, in addition to being a pastor. And one of the key directions that the college is going is inclusion, is one of including all people, regardless of sex, gender, or orientation. And we do that in a way that's pastoral, in a way that listens to the lived experiences of trans and gender diverse people. There is nothing in this document which listens to the experiences of trans and gender diverse people.
The document does say we must be attentive, not saying all are the same, that transgender people must be accompanied. So there does appear to be a certain pastoral concern.
I think they're couching it in some pastoral language, but it's very difficult to be pastoral when you say in this document that trans and gender diverse people are eliminating the anthropological basis of the family, that trans and gender diverse people are a threat to the very foundation of the family. When you say, we want to be pastoral, we want to walk alongside you, we want to listen to you, and when in the same document you say that trans and gender diverse people are a threat to the family, that is not pastoral.
Alex, isn't there, though, surely a danger of politicising a person's very genuine struggle with identity by really turning it into, you know, a political theory, a political message? Because you, as someone who has walked alongside gender diverse Christians for a long time now, both as a pastor, also in your training at a top seminary in the United States, you would know that these are very personal things, and often they do become an unnecessary political cause, don't they?
I see firsthand the damage of politicizing and throwing into the political spotlight the real journeys and the real difficulties that trans and gender diverse people face. They're just people, human beings, children of God, who are trying to live their lives and are trying to be authentic. In 2004 and 2005, in the United States, when same-sex marriage bans were put to a vote to ban same-sex marriage, there were a 37% increase in mood disorders amongst the LGBTI people and a 248% increase in generalized anxiety disorders. There are measurable mental health impacts that come with trying to politicize the journeys of trans and gender diverse people. I feel like this document contributes to that politicization by taking it out of the lived experiences and turning it into a debate about gender theory versus traditional values.
But wouldn't you have seen over the years, as I guess many of us have, people who for many years were quite happily and confidently identifying as gay and lesbian, who maybe 10 years ago discovered that they wanted to call themselves non-binary, for example? Isn't that really a political statement rather than an expression of their gender or their sexual identity? They've made it a political statement. Many people outside of a university environment, outside of an anthropology faculty, wouldn't have heard the notion of non-binary until 6 or 7 years ago.
Look, you know, there are elements to discussions around gender which do talk about, I suppose you could say, political elements to them, particularly when you get to, you know, gender studies and cultural studies in universities. I get that. And, you know, when you go against the grain of expressing a gender that is different to what people assume of you, that can be in some ways political in that it challenges the way in which people perceive gender. But at the same time, the people who I minister to, the people who I walk with, are just looking to live their lives.
That's Alex Pittaway, a minister with the Metropolitan Community Church in Brisbane and a Queensland University chaplain. And you're with Andrew West. Remember that first flush of excitement back in the mid-90s when perhaps that one computer in the office was hooked up to the internet? And here it was, the modern miracle of technology that Paul Keating called the information superhighway. Well, 25 years on, you curse as your kids and grandkids bury their heads and effectively their brains in their smartphones and their tablets. Peter Lewis was a journalist and then a consultant working mainly with unions when he first became excited about the democratic potential of the web. He's had some serious second thoughts, though, and he discusses them in a new book, Webtopia, The Worldwide Wreck of Tech and How to Make the Net Work. And Peter Lewis joined me in the Sydney studio.
What the web offered the world was an ability to connect across time and space, which is a remarkable gift. And we embraced it and we found so many ways of applying it. And it was a self-evident good that connectivity and sharing of information, you couldn't get enough of it. It feels to me that we've reached a point where we're being swamped by it and it's actually starting to impinge on our humanity. Mm. And by that I mean that I feel that our primary relationship has shifted from being relationships with other people through the institutions that we use to organize society through to being a relationship with the technology. Mm. And on one level, with the technology to connect to other people. But I think more and more, it is just a one-way loop where we're using technology just to reinforce ourselves. And in doing so, something about ourself gets taken away.
Well, the main thing that gets taken away is a traditional bent towards humility, especially when you write about the parable of Narcissus. Narcissism, self-love, lack of self-awareness. That's a big ethical problem, a big ethical challenge, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it's a challenge that requires space for self-reflection. As I write in the chapter, like the sense that humans have been going down this path of being totally self-consumed predates the web. And I refer to Christopher Lasher's fantastic thinking from the 70s. But what's happened, particularly over the last decade, has been the business model of the web is to keep us looking into this mirror for longer and longer. And in fact, what we look at has become the product that the web then sells back to us. Mm. And as I also note, there is no business model in the web in turning off and thinking and reflecting. And for people who aspire to an inner life, that's really problematic. Yeah.
You do try to talk about the inner life in your book, Webtopia, and you reflect on faith communities. You reflect on one particular faith community, that of Pastor Brad Chilcott. Now, he's used the web in a way that emphasizes community and connectedness. What has he done with the web?
He's really interesting. He has established a faith community in Adelaide called the Activate Church, where the whole mission is what you're doing outside the church into the community, which I know a lot of churches do this, but these guys
this
really...
This is the classic bridging capital that a lot of faith communities have.
So his big initiative is something called Welcome to Australia that started off with a few families in his community, has become a national movement. Its political mission is to open up homes for refugees and share a meal with them. So it's a really humble, basic connection point. Now, I think it's an interesting thing because Brad does use the web. He uses the web to connect people together, to organise things. And when I was talking about the ideas with him, he goes, it's not that the web is the problem. It's the way we use it that's the problem. And if we're using the web to feel good about ourselves or feel angry, then it is an indulgence. But if we are actually creating connections that then we translate into real world mission and purpose, then it can be a fantastic tool. So again, I don't think technology is the problem. Like that would be a silly proposition to say technology is the problem. I think we're the problem and our tendency to get comfortable and just seek a feel-good echo chamber with what we put out and what comes back.
Yeah, but you see, Brad's been lucky in this sense that he has used the web in a way that speaks of compromise, because his model, a church model of using the web, is to find common ground. Mm. Peter, you've worked in the media for 30 years. You know that's increasingly not the model now, except for outstanding examples like Brad Chilcott at that church. The web isn't about finding common ground, is it? Well, the web's about shouting.
But it could be. The problem is the shouting is actually the business model of the web, which is to keep people in one place longer. And, you know, particularly, you know, the algorithms that your social media channels like Facebook use, which tend to give back to you what you're putting out. So you're not challenged to connect with other views. They call them echo chambers. And the algorithms say that I'm more likely to like something I've already liked, so I'll keep giving someone something I've already liked, which is totally, you know, antithetical to curiosity and humility and the things that we actually need to thrive as humans. Mm. And You know, when I start talking about this, I sound like I'm proselytizing, which is not what I'm trying to do. I'm
no, just we to want say you that to proselytize. No, let me give you a pulpit. Proselytize, Peter.
It just seems to me that somewhere along the way, we're losing our sense of humanity. And as most people of faith realize, you need to exercise these things and you can get flabby and unfit. And if it's all too comfortable and easy, then of course you're not going to be able to get up and do the push-ups that you need to do to create a sense of purpose. And I'm not a particularly religious person, but I do fear that if we go down this track and we end up just being consumers who are only interacting with this technology to fulfill our desires, then we do become replicable. Like if we want to retain our humanity in this amazing change that we're going through, then we need to do some work on it.
Yeah, the reason I say, though, a lot of it's not about finding common ground, even though you've found some excellent examples in faith communities, but also in the world of trade unions. But even though my impression is, based on a job where, frankly, I get lobbied by both sides of an argument relentlessly to give them a platform, is that anything that resembles compromise is seen as capitulation. And essentially what you've got is a model that allows what is dismissed as, you know, and probably accurately as virtue signaling. If you look like you've got the right attitudes, you can get away with not doing much. Is that not part of the problem with the webtopia, the false utopia of the web?
Look, I think the individuating of worldviews is challenging. So everything about the business models of social media is to understand us as an individual. And I think that what you're talking to is our tendency to lose connection with other views. And it does lead to a polarization, doesn't it? And what's frustrating is the whole premise of the web was it was going to be this tool to bring people together in collaboration to create things that had never been created before. And I don't see much really being created at the moment apart from anger and outrage. And when that flows into political discussions, they're not very productive, are they?
Let's talk about truth, because that's something else that you write about. It seems evident in a world of Trump and of Russian bots and of bloggers who come out of back rooms in Bulgaria and places like that, that the web has actually warped truth. What has the web done to our notion of truth?
Well, it's destroyed the public square. It's, in a way, it's privatized the public square and individuated the public square. And if we've got nowhere to anchor basic facts, then we're all going to lose our compass. I do think the notion of objective truth is so central to the Enlightenment and to the way that our worlds evolve that it's really concerning that we can't even come up with some basic agreement, for instance, that we're facing an environmental challenge.
Peter Lewis is a Sydney-based media consultant. His new book is Webtopia, The Worldwide Wreck of Tech and How to Make the Net Work. Peter, thanks for joining us to discuss some big ethical issues on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thanks so much, Andrew.
And that is the program for this week. You can subscribe to the Religion and Ethics Report at the ABC Listen app or iTunes, where you can give us a rating. Good or bad, we'll take them all. And you can also subscribe to our newsletter. Go to abc.net.au/religion and subscribe at the bottom of the page. Thanks to Mudita Dias and Emerus Cronin. I'm Andrew West. I'm back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.